Well, hot dog, everybody.
This is Brett. Today is Saturday, April 11th, feeling pretty energized. You know, when I feel really energized, I like to exclaim, hot dog. You know, like the food. So why? What's all the energy about? Well, earlier today, I have to say, I was really pleased with a recording that I did with Daryl Becker. We were able to put the fourth installment of the Scientific Consensus versus Dissent series in the can. The can is a place where podcasts go before they become MP3 files. It's a process. So, yeah, it's a long conversation, like well over 2 hours we spent, I think. But the longer the show goes on, the deeper we get, you know, the further we go. It's kind of like the movie Interstellar. Maybe not as good. I don't know. When the podcast is out, I guess, you know, we can put them side by side and you guys can judge. But really positive, really energizing experience for me. And there's some other cool news related to me and the show as well. You're going to hear something today that I recorded very late last night, wee hours of the morning. And the reason why I was up is I'm kind of like adjusting my sleep schedule a little bit to prepare for what is, to me anyway, a pretty cool opportunity that's coming at 1 a.m. Eastern on Monday morning. I am going to get to co-host what has become one of my favorite radio shows in the last couple months, The Freedom Fiends. I was invited by Derek J. to sit in with him. So you can stream it if you stay up that late on the East Coast, or you know, maybe you live out west. I hear as you go further west, the day has a tendency to get earlier. So if you're someplace like Montana, which would be an example of that, might be more convenient for you. But love the Freedom Fiends. Had a lot of fiends on the show in the past, including its creator, Michael Dean, but also Ben Stone, Bill Buport, Derek J., Nick Hazelton, Davi Barker. Sorry if I'm forgetting anyone. And I'm glad that I finally get to be involved. So I've been, adjusting the sleep schedule a little bit to prepare. But what was I doing with my time? I was recording something that I wrote. And many of you might be saying, Brett, you're not a writer. This was actually the very first thing that I have ever written for publication. It is the foreword to the second edition of the book Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against Child Protective Services, written by our good friend Carlos Morales. If you'd like to get a copy of the book, you can go to legallykidnapped.net. A very important look at a very dangerous and often overlooked government agency, CPS. Now, I can hear at least one voice saying,
oh, I see, Brett. Whenever one of your friends writes a book, you'll just promote it on your show for free?
Yeah, Larry, I f***ing will. But I also thought that my audience might appreciate this story. So let me tell you a little bit about how this process went down. First of all, I got to say, I was really honored that Carlos would ask a non-writer to participate in a book, which is a writing project, you know, lots of writing involved. So I started doing some research into, you know, what are some guidelines for the foreword for a book? And turns out there aren't any. Turns out the only guideline is it can't be pictures. You know, it's got to be text. So we started talking about what I could do to enhance a short and focused book that is filled with a ton of research and information on a variety of CPS-related topics. So what I decided to do was add this personal story, my personal story. I worked in schooling and social services for like 13 years. And there were some bullet points that I wanted to hit. The audience of the book is fairly diverse, so I wanted to make sure there were some valuable takeaways for, you know, whether it was somebody working inside the system, somebody who is like a more liberty-minded person skeptical of government, or somebody who's actually found themselves maybe unjustly under the boot of the system. And those bullet points included this real need for skepticism about the efficacy of government systems to solve complex social problems, something we've certainly discussed on the show before. I think many of us are actually in agreement about the verdict there. But more importantly, the futility of trying to reform these systems. And also a look at, for lack of a better description, the emotional costs of the failure to be a team player in a corrupt organization. But most importantly, at least with respect to my story, this wonderful light that I eventually found at the end of a pretty dark tunnel. I set out 15 years ago with, you know, kind of weird motivations at the time, just out of college, this idealistic lefty that I wanted to teach and help children. And there was only one way to go. There's only one place to be if you wanted to do those things. You know, you work for the government or some government-supported or government-controlled agency. But in the last 5+ years, I found out that that's not the case. You don't have to stick yourself there. So here's what we came up with. I called this Work Outside the System. I hope you enjoy it. I look forward to your feedback. You know, when I was thinking about like dabbling in writing before, I remember somebody said, just write like you talk. And I said, what if I talk like this? And they said, ooh, okay, not you, but, you know, as a general rule. But it turns out, you know, I don't write like I talk at all. So it was actually like a really interesting experience listening to myself read this into, you know, an audio file. And, you know, another thing is that time, those wee hours of the morning, really interesting time to work. I found myself in a very different kind of mental space. So you can check me out in that space again, Monday, 1 a.m. on The Fiends, lrn.fm, and look for the fourth installment in our Scientific Consensus versus Dissent series coming very soon. Huge thanks and appreciation to Carlos Morales for asking me to participate in this important project. The site again is legallykidnapped.net if you want to learn more or get the book. And if you already have it, please think about reviewing it on Amazon. That also helps. All right, everyone. Thanks so much. Here we go. He rings his pony to the gate of the school. Feather pens and ink, wears of hand-me-down rules. Like trading a pony for an aging mule, he rides away without fear. After spending over a decade in fields erroneously referred to as education and social services, I managed to fail my way into happiness. And after accumulating my long list of professional failures, I retreated from the system with the following lessons. 1. Most people have the best of intentions. 2. Unfortunately, the good intentions of the many often enable the corruption of the few. 3. It is virtually impossible to fight corruption from inside the system, because the well-intentioned people have no power there. And 4. If you really want to help children, you have to work outside the system. During my tenure in state-funded boarding schools and on the periphery of the public education system, I also learned that well-intentioned people are extremely useful in corrupt organizations. We can do paperwork, attend to logistics, meet quotas, sit attentively through staff meetings, and move stacks of paperwork from inboxes to outboxes. In fact, with the right training, we seem capable of almost anything outside of asking relevant questions about the corruption or failure itself. That's why a book like Legally Kidnapped can have such a great impact. If capable and well-intentioned people were able to arm themselves with more facts, imagine what a better world they could help to build. I met this book's author, Carlos Morales, in the summer of 2013. It was a few months after he left his job with CPS, and we quickly bonded over a common experience. Although we had traveled our own unique paths through different professions, we both came to the same unsettling realization. Despite our aspirations to help young people, we had naively served institutions and systems that hurt too many of them. While my awakening was slow and often tedious, Carlos's revelations were fast and intense. This book reflects that. It moves swiftly and hits all of its targets. It offers a concise and practical examination of one of the least questioned and consequently most corrupt, quote-unquote, social services operations in the country, while elucidating everything from the overarching mission of CPS to the steps to take if an investigator suddenly shows up at your door. Because Legally Kidnapped is short and focused, I wish to add to it a personal account. My story maps the evolution of a worker in a deeply corrupted field. Charting my path from a naive, obedient, and well-intentioned entry-level employee to a confident and inquisitive professional who ultimately tried to take positive action. I share it here and elsewhere in the hopes that more people will choose to walk a similar path. When I first read Carlos's accounts about his time at CPS, I was immediately transported back to the early days of my career. This was a difficult experience. Even years after I'd left the toughest parts of that career behind, I was still haunted by some of the things I saw, many of the actions I took, the psychiatric drugs I handed out, and the numerous opportunities for peaceful solutions with young people I missed. I was angered by the realization that children were merely products we were warehousing, and that they were often further damaged by previous state, family court, and CPS interventions. In the first chapter of Legally Kidnapped, Carlos writes, quote, "In investigating my own role within CPS, it's hard not to get emotional. Emotions are not enough, but they do propel me to move forward in my search for truth," unquote. I wanted to add some detail about the emotional costs of this type of social service work. These costs extend beyond the consequences of raising questions and speaking out in organizations that resist having certain layers peeled back. The work itself is deeply emotional for those who care at all about the people they supposedly serve. Because of the stories in this book, many readers may come to regard CPS investigators and bureaucrats as malicious or thoughtless. But most social service workers had good intentions before the system wore them down. When I began my ill-fated social service career in the year 2000, I was fresh out of college and overflowing with idealistic visions and passion. I was so eager to relish the positive differences I could make in the lives of adolescents. I was going to teach. My professional path seemed so straight and clear. Strangely enough, I spent most of the next decade learning my way out of one job after another. No matter how challenging and enjoyable a position seemed at first, my observations, questions, and subsequent realizations would eventually destroy my enthusiasm and willingness to continue. This frustrating process repeated for me in virtually every new station around the public and semi-private schooling system. And I tried numerous stations: boarding school residential counselor, dorm supervisor, outdoor educator, teacher's assistant, behavior manager, lead teacher, history teacher, academic tutor, No Child Left Behind tutor, SAT group tutor, college consultant. By 2009, while serving as the vice president of a tutoring company, I finally accepted that I was never going to find lasting satisfaction and enjoyment in the quote-unquote education profession if I had to continue working on the education profession's terms. Was something wrong with me? Did I have ADD or oppositional defiant disorder? After all, if I could not placidly adjust myself to the existing system, I must be stricken with some personal defect or dysfunction. At least that was how I had been trained to view the children under my care. It couldn't have been a problem with the system itself. Most of us learn that destructive lesson in school or elsewhere. Yet upon much reflection, I eventually realized that my experience working in private and around public schools had actually taught me a much more definitive and meaningful lesson. The unfortunate truth was that many of society's systems and institutions are deeply dysfunctional, largely due to a professional failure to question them from within. In my first teaching position, I remember feeling troubled by my discovery
that many of our educational and therapeutic practices were alarmingly suboptimal. I remember feeling quite vexed and inconvenienced by the frequent notion that I should probably change careers. I remember feeling saddened and ultimately infuriated by the conclusion that I had been working against the real educational interests of young people. But above all, I remember feeling diminished by the almost unanimous supervisor and peer reactions to my questions and concerns. It was annoyance and contempt. At first, I was naive enough to be surprised there was no reward for taking such initiative. After all, I thought I had identified specific, solvable problems. Why weren't the middle managers and administrators interested or appreciative? Why was everyone else tacitly conforming to this anti-educational mayhem we called a school? Many years later, I started to find some answers to those questions. In 2007, I began an intensive process of reflection in an effort to make sense of my disconcerting professional experiences. I studied the history of and the founding ideologies behind government-run and regulated schooling. I asked questions about the nature of that government and its ability to solve complex social problems. I started gathering some disturbing facts, which eventually led me to start recording and editing these investigations and reflections. Within a year, they transformed into the most satisfying educational work I've ever done, the School Sucks podcast. While the moniker has offended quite a few people, the term school sucks is actually a very astute synopsis of the system and one that accurately encompassed the answers to many of my questions. When people first enter school, they're curious, innovative, individualistic, creative, and optimistic. Yet 12 years later, for far too many, those essential qualities have either vanished or dwindled. School has seemingly replaced those natural abilities with conformity, obedience, apathy, and a crippling fear of failure. Then, as the finished products of this schooling process, people go on to staff the professions, social services, law enforcement, and the corporate world. Some become teachers or CPS investigators. Most are quite comfortable commiserating with coworkers about the finite and mundane burdens of their jobs, but they don't ask meaningful questions about the overall nature and purpose of their work. They have been thoroughly trained to simply go with the flow, which also makes anyone who doesn't acquiesce appear dangerously maladjusted by comparison. In the social services, there are plenty of people who are capable of recognizing problems and then desiring solutions, but it's usually a quiet and personal process, often interrupted and terminated by denial or rationalization. They say things like, "If I want to change the system, I must work within the system." This is such a pernicious declaration for the individual, the insistence that each of us must remain subsumed by the collective. This declaration, when repeated with great frequency by enough people, actually ensures a corrupt system's continuity and survival. You can change government and quasi-governmental agencies and systems from within about as successfully as you can tame a lion after it eats you. And any meaningful change from inside is usually ephemeral. These systems are designed to maintain an equilibrium for the powerful interests they've come to benefit: unions, service contractors, corporations, and politicians in the case of the schools. And such reform efforts ensure great personal sacrifice, stress, frustration, and eventual failure. For those of us who care about helping children or people in general, we must recognize that the existing government service structures have not been set up, maintained, or expanded with any of us in mind. Furthermore, considering the powers potential change agents face, they would be wise to ask themselves, how small and ineffective do I want to feel? and how long can I endure that feeling? Eventually, the whole work within the system edict leads most of these idealists to feel worn down and powerless. They soon realize that it's time to give up and begrudgingly accept the status quo. From my observations, this process usually doesn't take very long. In 2002, I entered graduate school to pursue a master's degree in something called educational leadership. I sat in classrooms with young men and women who had recently begun their public school teaching careers, and I learned more from these novice teachers than I did from any professor. They collectively taught me a devastating lesson, that the public schooling system sucks professional autonomy, motivation, and self-esteem away, and we all need to reevaluate our childlike enthusiasm for teaching. Now, that isn't a direct quote, but it seemed to be an ever-present subtext of our class discussions. They also taught me that the work was more about professional survival than it was about student enrichment. Most of my grad school peers had been teaching for 2 or 3 years. That's it. That's all the time it took to transform most of them from passionate idealists to world-weary realists. And despite their frequent complaints about the system, they were all there to earn their master's degrees, which was a requirement to continue working as teachers in that same onerous system. There were no alternatives for them. After a couple months of growing despondence, I finally accepted the only lesson I can remember learning in those college classrooms. Public schools were torturous environments, and teaching in one wasn't for me. And I dropped out. Believing I had cleverly escaped the old work within the system trap, I decided to make the most of the private school teaching job I had at the time. This environment is certainly free of the impediment and intransigence of the public system, I reassured myself. So, dissatisfied with the curriculum, injunctions, and student-staff interactions in the program I ran, I set out to reform all of it. Despite the almost unanimous supervisor and peer annoyance and contempt I mentioned earlier, I managed to develop a new curriculum based on life skills and consumer economics. I rewrote the school rules with clinical supervision, and I launched the first school-wide newspaper with my students as writers, editors, and photographers. By and large, the students embraced the new school experience. The other teachers, administrators, and students appreciated the newspaper. After 2 years, I was offered a better job within the same organization. It was the only time in my career that I moved to a new station with enthusiasm for and satisfaction with what I was leaving behind. I had successfully changed a very small system from the inside. About 6 months later, I checked in on my old campus. The newspaper had been discontinued due to lack of staff interest. The old forbidding rules had returned. Student-staff relations had deteriorated. The more empowering and appropriate life skills curriculum had been abandoned. Every aspect of the program had reverted back to what was most convenient for those in charge. It was like I was never there. So what was the end result of 4 years of working my way up to a position where I thought I could have an impact? An overwhelming feeling of powerlessness, failure, and dejection. I chose to share this one frustrating experience over many others as it sums up the careers of so many ambitious social service workers and educators, which is a seemingly ongoing collision between initiative and inertia. However, it was a powerful lesson and a crucial turning point. With a clear understanding of the schooling terrain, I began cutting a path to the truly successful educational work I spoke of earlier. It was 2004, and I had compiled a list of priorities that translated to an exciting new professional mission. Number one, reduce stress. Number two, find autonomy and independence. Number three, exercise creativity. Number four, identify and follow my passions. Number five, escape bureaucracy. Number 6, stop participating in the problem. The problem was these directives, if followed absolutely, left me nowhere to work. And it was that lack of opportunity that turned out to be a blessing in disguise. The circumstances forced me to recognize that even though I couldn't change the system, I could survive and escape it. And I could probably encourage others to do the same. It was the perfect job description for me. And since no job like that existed, I started to create it. At first, mostly by accident, and ultimately through a long process of trial and error. By 2011, I was getting paid to produce audio and video content on critical thinking, emotional intelligence, productivity, communication, peaceful parenting, and a wide range of historical topics. I'd refined my mission to reclaim the word education from those who used institutionalized schools to mold impressionable minds, and to present education as a lifelong journey by the individual, for the individual. The small podcast with the word sucks in the title had grown into a flourishing online community. 2 years later, I was finally free of all restraints of the schooling system, while still able to do the one thing I'd been so passionate about for so long, teach. Today, I still operate on the belief that most people are capable and well-intentioned, and I hope to share with them information, skills, and strategies they can use to build a better world for themselves and for others, as I try to do the same for myself. On a weekly basis, I'm able to provide real educational content because I'm not under the control of any system or bureaucracy. I'm able to maintain control, motivation, and enthusiasm for what I teach. The project has now reached hundreds of thousands of people and made a substantial positive impact on the lives of students, parents, and even some teachers. I'm encouraged knowing that every time I add a new post to my website, I reach as many people in a day as I could have reached in about 30 years of teaching in the system. It has been a dramatic evolution from powerlessness and dejection to freedom and tranquility in just 5 short years. Now, I've presented my experience here as a great success story, but is that really objective? Most education or social services professionals would read these accounts or read my resume and only see someone who had failed at almost everything. Failure to follow the system's rules, failure to be a good employee, failure to be a good graduate student, failure to be a team player. And the truth is, I wasn't a visionary. I wasn't guided by integrity. I was just, like, really lazy about doing things that felt wrong. At the time, most of these failures were quite painful and frustrating. But in retrospect, I wish more professionals could learn to be less afraid of this type of failure. Please keep my story in mind as you read Legally Kidnapped. If you're discouraged by what you learn about the system, we assure you there is always another way. If you feel small and powerless, remember that supportive networks are available and new ones are being built. If I had not failed my way into School Sucks Project, I never would have met Carlos Morales. We wouldn't be able to share ideas, collaborate, or offer each other support. Carlos came into our community in 2012, and he quickly impressed me with how he was able to leverage his experience to assist people across the country. His efforts, this book included, exemplify the expanding influence I hoped alternative education could have. If you read this book as a skeptic or a critic of government systems, remember all of the concerned voices in that system being silenced on a regular basis. Think of all the others who might lose sleep at night over what they do but don't know how to effectively speak out. Almost every teacher, every police officer, or CPS investigator experiences some of the sentiments I've expressed here. Many have concerns, doubts, frustrations, or even a quiet opposition to the systems they serve. So please remember to honor the rare few who have the courage to speak out. If you read this book as a worker in education, law enforcement, or social services, I encourage you to look for ways to take control and ownership of your life. I encourage you to strive for freedom and satisfaction in your work. The opportunities are out there. If not, they can be created. And if you read this book as someone who is currently and unjustly trapped in the CPS or some other government system, thank you for taking the time to educate and empower yourself. The world needs more people like you.